This is MR Radio, I'm GW, and Daniel is with me online as usual. Today, our guest is one of the few genuine thinkers and scholars in our movement. He is the editor of Countercurrents. He is Greg Johnson. And Greg describes himself as having a doctorate in philosophy and interest in the history of philosophy, focus on German philosophy, political philosophy, and even modern philosophy. And he would like to see us re-examine the entire Western canon and maybe refocus its usefulness for our own purposes as, let's say, champions of European man, which I think we would want to call ourselves. Greg, thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us. Nice to have you along.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Okay. We've all come up with slightly different views of where we want this interview to go. I suspect it's going to have a life of its own. But I'm going to be very selfish and try to steer things a little bit in the direction that I want to go. We start from a particular posture that has to be rooted in the great crisis that we face, which is fundamentally a demographic crisis and an existential crisis. We all recognize this. It doesn't need any further explication from me. But I think it's interesting when one's looking at it from the point of view of philosophical grounding, that we understand that it has its roots in ideas and not merely in the actions of interest groups, of capitalists, Jews, or whatever they may be, that there is an ideational element we've got here through ideas. The world is made in this way for us, and we're living this life, which is leading us towards an extremely grave and serious collective outcome. So which particular streams of thought would you pick out as being the most dangerous for us today and the ones which need the most urgent attention intellectually?
Well, that's a good question. I think the worst ideas that we're facing right now are basically ideas that separate man, the human agency, human moral worth, our human self-image, from biology,
yeah,
and from sex, and from the physical, biological substratum of mankind. Because if you look at the political ideas that are being pushed forward today, basically there's this notion that all human beings can be part of some single global civilization, that the impediments to integrating all human beings into that single global civilization basically boil down to the evil motives of white people. Mm-hmm. If only white people would stop being so evil and bad, we could fit everybody into this grand global utopia. And it's just not true. The fact of the matter is that people are differentiated by biological factors. We're differentiated by sex. The women and men think differently, act differently, and there are different forms of life that are more appropriate to males and females. The different races and different sub-races are differentiated, and that means that there are going to be different forms of life that are comfortable fits
and different forms of mind,
different forms of culture, just in broad terms, different forms of life. And basically the utopia that the left and really the right, which just follows them like a shadow today, what the establishment wants is the equivalent of a society where everybody wears sort of one size fits all Mao suits or something, right? There's one civilization that fits all people. Any differences that seem to impede that, well, those are simply historical artifacts, right, that we will overcome in the future. Nature doesn't matter. Nature doesn't put any fundamental impediments in the way of human equality, a conflict for utopia, and things like that. That's the core set of bad ideas that we have to fight.
Obviously, there's an element of Jewish thought, a heavy element of Jewish thought about the Gentile in this, and a lot of liberalism through Christianity echoes the way that Jews consider who and what we are and what our destiny should be. But setting that aside, we know about that. It's not something that we need to dwell on particularly in this interview. What aspects of the liberal intellectual tradition would you say are most salient in leading to the situation that we find ourselves in?
Yeah, well, I'm mulling this over. the liberal tradition, in general, I think is a good thing. I'm just going to say this. I think that a lot of features of modern liberalism are very good. I just think that the underlying error of liberalism is the assumption that liberalism is a universally applicable political and moral outlook, because I don't think that's true. Liberalism presupposes a homogeneous, high-trust society where there is a great deal of moral reciprocity. And when you take those liberal attitudes and you put them in contact with other peoples that do not share that liberal outlook and those basic moral assumptions, what you get is you get a situation where you have people who are committed to being individualistic and open to strangers, encountering people who basically look upon that as a weakness that they're going to exploit. And I think really that basically is the formula for all the kind of asymmetrical, parasitic, and exploitative relationships that whites have gotten themselves in with non-white groups. But I think that it's a highly adaptive set of beliefs and attitudes when you're dealing with other white people. Whites have been able to create large-scale, high-trust societies because when we encounter strangers, we don't just think of them as enemies or people to exploit or people to destroy. We think of them as potential friends. And therefore, we have this tendency to want to let down our guard, to make friendly overtures, to take risks that are necessary to bring these strangers into a broader high-trust social network. And when you read the history of Western colonialism, you find all kinds of tales, like, for instance, in the 17th century, the Puritans in New England, who were constantly putting out their hand in friendship to the Native Americans, right, the Indian tribes, thinking that if they were just self-sacrificial, trusting, risk-taking enough, and if they could show their goodwill, that these people would become members of society, a society basically defined on their own terms. And they found again and again that that wasn't happening. They would try that, but then there'd be little misunderstandings that would flare up into tribal conflicts and massacres and wars. And it was a dysfunctional attitude in the context of the New World. But in the context of the Old World, when, you know, our people emerged evolutionarily in the crucible of the Ice Ages, right? There were small groups of white people roaming around, and if they encountered another group of white people, the ability to fuse with that group and to create a larger high-trust social institution or network or, you know, social unit, I should say, that can make the difference between survival and not.
Yes,
and
it may have been...
That's important.
It would have been quite an adaptive behavior, I suspect.
Yes, and I do think that liberal attitudes, liberal doctrines, our sense of fair play, our sense of the honorableness of taking risks to expand one's social unit, those sorts of attitudes are basically just articulations and rationalizations of deeper evolutionarily functional behavior patterns that emerged very early on with our race.
Right.
Very well said. And I've made that mistake myself, and it was narcissistically treating others in a liberal way who weren't going to reciprocate.
Right. And the key is reciprocity. If if they will reciprocate, then it's okay. If not, it becomes a form of exploitation and it leads to our destruction. But whites are so fixated on the, and this is ethnocentrism, let's face it, this is pure white ethnocentrism. We think that the whole world wants to be like us, and why wouldn't they, right? We've done such marvelous things. And we don't realize that what we're really doing is demanding that they change themselves fundamentally into something they're not.
It's called the narcissism of modernity.
Right. It's a kind of imperialism when you get right down to it. And liberals are just as guilty of that as conservatives. Liberals want the whole world to be like New England, right, or England. They think that everybody in Africa, in the Pacific Isles, in the Far East, would like to have the same kind of high trust, high-minded society that they have in England or New England. And I think that's a grave error. And what that has allowed to happen is we've got this extremely hostile situation now where you've got a leftist elite, which is essentially liberal-minded, that has been infiltrated by Jews who are exploiting that mentality mm-hmm. for their own aims. Mm-hmm. And the liberal left elite is profoundly alienated from the rest of their people,
yes.
right? The white working class, the white middle class, any whites that don't go along with this. Usually what that means is whites that don't have the cushion of wealth and privilege that they have that allows them to engage in these kinds of social experiments, even though they think they're very egalitarian. Okay. And they're fighting a war against those people, those evil white people who won't conform, who won't open up, who won't get along, who are less high-minded than themselves. And in fighting that war, they side instinctively with these non-whites. Africans, Asians, whatever. And they actually find that if they can bring these people in and integrate them into the society and give them votes, that will be their way of beating these other people. And I actually had a conversation in San Francisco with this very cultured, very intelligent woman who's a typical San Francisco Democrat. And she explained to me why immigration from the third world is so important. And I said, okay, so let me get this straight. You think that when you fill this country up with Mexicans and Africans and Muslims, none of whom have any use for women's rights, gay rights, the arts, you know, environmentalism, and so forth, that once they become the majority, they're all going to continue to take orders from San Francisco white liberals, and you're going to have your utopia? And she sort of got quiet because she realized that, you know, I was obviously putting it in a somewhat biased way. But yeah, that's their policy. And then they, quote unquote, win. Well, it's madness. It really is madness, because once these people have the power to do what they want, they're not going to continue to take orders from these people that they find to be contemptible and out of touch. So that's sort of the dynamic that we've got going on with the liberal white, right?
The most elite famous liberal. Case of that is Jens Orback, isn't it? This integration minister, as was in Sweden, who I think in 2006 uttered the famous and much quoted phrase, it will always be hung around his neck, I suspect, "We must be open and tolerant toward Islam and Muslims, because when we become a minority, they will be so toward us." Incredible.
It's incredible. And of course, the very idea that it's inevitable that we will become the minority in our own country, that's even more questionable than the claim that they will be tolerant towards us. When did that become an inevitability? Why exactly is that inevitable?
Yes, because it's what they want to do. It shows you
it's what they want to do.
It's a designed process. It's not one that is happening because it's a force of nature, or because, you know, poor people want to improve themselves, or because transport is cheap and easy, or any of the reasons that they throw up to cover the fact that they're actually designing this. They've thrown the borders open, they've invited these people in, they've made the whole thing possible, and they're just, when they provide these other reasons for it, which
so was Heidegger trying to address this universalizing of liberalism, and was he offering tools to correct it?
Heidegger, not really. No, I don't think so. But what Heidegger does do that I think is useful to the new right is he tries to get away from this universalized and deracinated notion of human identity. Now, he's not a racialist, I think for mistaken reasons, but he is against universalism in this sense. He doesn't think that there is a universal view from nowhere. He really thinks that that human beings are differentiated, not differentiated so much by race and sex, by biology, as they are differentiated by history. But once you become differentiated by history, that doesn't just go away, right? Just because we didn't have to have this conversation, right? We didn't have to. You know, we scheduled it and then we put it off and then we rescheduled it and put it off. I'm embarrassed to rehearse how many times, but it didn't have to happen. But now that it has happened, this is part of the permanent record of the universe. Right.
Does Heidegger's concern with history, is that connected with hermeneutics?
Well, I mean, yes, but let's just set that aside for now because there's a few steps between them. Right. But what Heidegger is talking about really in Being in Time is he says, look, we're being in the world. We're not disembodied Cartesian subjects. And what that means is that who we are and how we see the world is uniquely marked by our language, by our historical situation, and so forth. And like I said, no historical event has to happen, right? They're contingent. When you're standing in the now and looking forward to the future, many historical events are possible. They're contingent. But once they do happen, they can never be undone, right? And therefore, historicity has a kind of weight to it that can't be just laughed off by these people who say, oh, well, this is a social construct, right? This didn't have to happen. Well, yeah, it didn't have to happen, but that doesn't mean that now we're entitled to ignore the fact that it did happen, because once something happens, it's as much a permanent part of the fabric of the universe as the laws of mathematics, right? Or any other kind of a priori necessity. And so history has a weight to it that we can't just shrug off. And when people talk about such and such being a social construct, really what they're trying to say is that social constructivism, in the left sense of the word, is basically a kind of metaphysical postulate of egalitarianism, right? Yes, men and women, you know, think differently and act differently, and women want to play with dolls and men want to play with guns, but these are just social constructs. The next step that they want to argue is that it can all be undone and it all can all be changed, even if these things are socially constructed, which I don't believe is true. But even if they were, they can't just be changed, right? You know, Montaigne talks about how we have a first nature, namely the nature we're born with, mm-hmm. and a second nature, which is the nature that we acquire over mm-hmm. time in our lives through the contingencies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, our personality. And he said, you know, I can no more change my second nature than I can change my first nature.
Yes, you can change your second nature. That is substantially true. But those parts of it into which nature itself does not intrude, because nature itself is one of the formative influences on personality. Personality cannot exist as a conflict with nature.
Right. Well, you know, you might have a bad habit, say. You might have the bad habit.
Yeah, at that level.
And you could change that habit.
Yes.
However, you will never become a person. You might become a non-smoker, but you will never become a person who has never smoked, right? Mm. And so even those things that you can change in the future still are part of the permanent record of your identity and the permanent record of the universe. They can't just be poofed out of existence in the pursuit of some kind of egalitarian social engineering project. But that's what the left believes. And a notion of nature, like you get with the classical philosophers, or a really robust and weighty understanding of historicity, like you get with Heidegger, both say no to that egalitarian project. we are not infinitely malleable. We cannot be all made into the citizens of some kind of rainbow utopia. The past will not be written over, and nature will not be written over. And so what I like about Heidegger is that he has this notion of being in time, of authenticity. And a lot of people, a lot of liberals really don't get this idea, because it really strikes at the core of what they're all about.
Exactly.
But what authenticity for Heidegger means is owning up to all the things that you cannot change about yourself. Owning up to the fact that certain things that didn't have to happen did happen and can never be undone. And beyond that, that is who we now are. And he does believe that there are different levels, right, of this. So in Being in Time, first of all, Being in Time really is a work that has to be read as part of the whole conservative revolutionary movement. There's a very good book by a German scholar named Johannes Fritzsche called National Socialism and Historical Destiny in Being in Time. And what he does in this book is really revolutionary, because he goes through, largely it's section 74 of Being in Time. He writes a whole book about this, but he puts it in context, namely by looking at writers like Max Scheler and Adolf Hitler using similar language, for one thing. And he puts it in the conservative revolutionary context. And very specifically, there was the conservative revolution in Germany largely arose after the First World War, and it consisted of men who had gone through the front experience. Right. It consisted of people like Ernst Jünger, most famously, but others who had gone through the war or who had known people who had gone through the war. All of Germany went through the war, even Heidegger, who couldn't serve because he had a heart condition. They all went through this, and he was reading the front literature. And these people came back, and they returned to both old forms of bourgeois life that they had lived before the war and the new Weimar Republic. And having gone through the experience of facing death, mass death on the fronts, they came to look at these things as trivial and false and empty, right? Especially the manufactured, decadent culture of Weimar. They looked at this as trivial, as meaningless, as empty, meretricious, whatever. And what they did is they wanted to reject that, but they didn't want to reject it in the name of some kind of disembodied or ahistorical idealism. What they wanted to do is they wanted to reject it in favor of something that was more authentically German, right?
You can't do
and,
that.
And yeah, and well, that's what they wanted to do.
I know
and
they
so
wanted
the,
to, but that's impossible.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, because
you can't prescribe, you shall be this way, you shall be that way. I mean, that ought to be the great lesson of our age, that inauthenticity raises its head in every possible circumstance. Human confusion, it's an endemic problem, and it's a problem of consciousness in its actual nature.
But is authenticity possible? This is what
yes,
they it thought.
Is. Yes, yeah, authenticity is possible, but you can't get at it that way. You can't get at it by saying, you know, oh, tradition. You can't get at it by saying, well, you know, we must be more conservative. You can't get it by saying, you know, walk this way. That's not how it is generated. The only way that you can get it is through a application of attention to consciousness. There is no other way that it comes. And that happens at the collective level. It can be done. And the National Socialists unwittingly achieved it, which is a point I've made to Daniel many times. He knows all about that, so I shan't bother him with it again. But
well,
I would like to explore this.
Yeah, I'd like to explore this, because what you've got in Being in Time is you have a critique of the they self. You have a critique of mass society, consumer mass society, and
yes.
so forth. This is the society that the front generation was rejecting. And then you have his account of authenticity. And there's a term that's translated as anticipatory resoluteness, which is a terrible, terrible, meaningless thing. The German is vorlaufende entschlossenheit. And what Fritzsche does is he says, look, this language, this term Vorlaufen, this is the language of the front, and it doesn't mean anticipation like a mental state. It means charging forth right. into danger.
Right.
And Heidegger actually talks about this Vorlaufende Entschlossenheit, you charge forth under the eyes of death. He's talking about the heroes who got out of the trenches and charged the machine guns,
yeah,
right?
But he's talking about spontaneity.
He's talking about the energy that
empowers yeah. spontaneity.
He's talking about charging into danger. And once you do that, you the encounter with death, right? And he's really talking about the encounter with death, forces you to separate the things that are important and unimportant. And for the front generation, what that really did was force them to separate what they thought was authentic and inauthentic. And the whole tendency of the conservative revolution is to try and get back to something that's a more authentic, organic, real form of political life. And that is really what Heidegger was thinking he was going to get when he joined the Nazi Party, when he supported it. He thought that this was an attempt of Germans to get back to a more authentic form of community that pushed aside a lot of superficial things, pushed aside superficial obsessions with class, for instance, pushed aside superficial, you know, bourgeois values, things like that. He was thinking it was a return to a more heroic, martial, and primally Germanic form of life within the context of modernity. And that's the hope that he had for it. And that, I think, is not a bad hope. I think that when we think today about the new right, when we think about what we're trying to do, I think that we are really offering a similar argument. We're saying, look, there's a crisis we're facing. Our race is facing a crisis. We're facing death. We're not facing it on the battlefield in a very bloody and palpable and real sense, which unfortunately is something we lack. We're facing it collectively far in the future, you know, and it can only be grasped abstractly, and that's one of the weaknesses of our arguments. But we are facing death. We're facing collective oblivion, and we have to separate out what's most important from what's less important. That's a question of who we are. It's a question of identity.
Right,
that's what I'm trying to get.
Yes, I understand completely. Can I just throw a suggestion at you, which is that Heidegger's concentration on being before death as a determining for presence, let's say, or at least a movement towards authenticity or an evaluation of what is before you that enables you to leave aside some things and choose that which you consider to be more authentic. You know, I don't particularly agree with that myself. It doesn't fit in with my own very meager thoughts on the subject. But death isn't the only way to address this problem. The other way to address the problem is love. And I don't think that Heidegger actually addressed this in a very productive way. But again, you know, when one turns, which he would call a step back, I suppose, but when one turns towards the natural and the conscious and away from personality and away from confusion, when things fall away and clarity is distilled, then the emotion which attends that is, in fact, love. It's not anything to do with death. I mean, the clarion call of danger and all the rest of it. You know, this is all very dramatic and masculine in this martial sense, and no doubt it seems incredibly glamorous and exciting to a lot of people. But the actual human truth, as it always is much more demure and ordinary. And also, in a way, much grander, which is that human beings actually love, and they choose what they love. I don't know, from my own readings into Heidegger, really what he had to say about that, and I think that it was a failing. But that failing arises because he absolutely set his face right at the beginning away from psychology and from practice. And in consequence of that, he left himself really without the possibility of commenting about what it actually means to be authentic in this sense. That is, this moment of awakening, which we would describe in a general sense as nationalism. And the other day I was on a newspaper thread, and somebody asked the question, "What do we do? What do we do?" And another person who I know, sometime connected to MR, simply said, "We become racially conscious. This is the force of love and connectedness and kinship, and it is a very powerful thing." And you said yourself, he wasn't a racial nationalist, and he eschewed the racial nationalism which arises quite naturally, I believe, and yet he's silent on it. And I think that's a great loss. However, we are where we
are.
Well,
I think that you know, Heidegger doesn't talk about love, as far as I know.
No.
There's no ladder of love like you have in Plato. He doesn't talk about these things at all. However, there is, I think, at the moment when one comes to an understanding of who one authentically is, that there's something inescapably collective about this. Mm. This is what Heidegger says. But it's not the inauthentic they, the we, the mass man. It's a recognition of an authentic belonging. And there is, at that point, I think, a place for talking about love of one's own, attachment to one's own, one's people, a sense of people. Heidegger does talk in one of his seminars about Schmitt's, the concept of the political.
Yes.
Schmitt focuses on enmity, but the flip side of the enemy is the friend,
yes,
right? But it's not just, but it's friendship amongst us, okay? There's friendship and there's enmity, there's them and there's us.
Yeah.
So the friend and the us coincide, and what you're really talking about is love of your own or preference for your own. I think the reason why Heidegger was hesitant to talk in terms of race is that he didn't think it was really necessary to talk in terms of race to explain the kind of awakening that he was seeing in Germany at the time.
Yeah.
It was the awakening of a historically German. Defined people, right? You know, the Czechs might be quite lovely white people of the same race, even more Nordic than the Germans, it turned out, but they weren't having the same awakening, right? Because there was something inescapably, ineluctably, historically situated about that awakening in Germany. And so I think that he looked upon race science as somewhat irrelevant for understanding what was really going on, and somewhat irrelevant for understanding identity.
Mm.
Now, it would have been, I think, relevant if somebody had said to him, "Well, Martin, what do you think of these young half-black lads who have grown up in the Rhineland, you know, in the last decade, you know, the offspring of rapes of German girls by Senegalese soldiers in the French army? Are they German? You know, they might speak German. They might be historically rooted in some way in the German people. But obviously that there is something different about them." At that point, I think he would have perhaps been brought around to an understanding of that. I do not think that there is a fundamental incompatibility between a kind of Heideggerian approach to human being and a scientific approach.
Right.
I think he believed there was. I think
he
one of the reasons
he didn't read Darwin, though. He's like Nietzsche in that respect. He did not bring at any point all too concrete scientism, perhaps, in his view. Of evolutionary theory into his thinking.
I think that what Heidegger basically worried about was that there was a tendency of science to say, we can dispense with the human world, the human categories, and we can have a different view from nowhere, a non-human view on things, which is what objective science gives us.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a possibility of science, a view of science that's consistent with what somebody like Heidegger is saying, which is that, no, science is not a non-human view from nowhere on reality. Science is a human outlook on reality. It's an important human outlook on reality that gives us access to things that are not otherwise available through, say, common sense, ordinary practice, and so forth.
It can be, yeah. But it's also been abused scientifically.
It's been abused.
Yeah. And Heidegger was addressing that. You've got people saying that racial differences are just a matter of a few chromosomes or something, and it's no big deal. That's scientism.
Well, I think what scientism is, you know, in the bad sense, is basically science saying, look, we can dispense with philosophy, we can dispense with metaphysics, we just have this really neat project that is discovering quantifiable relationships, predictable relationships, things that we can insert our lever into and move the world with, and that's all we need, right?
It's more, scientism is more than that.
Yeah, well, the question is, you know, the question of what is man? Well, that's going to be determined by mapping the human genome. Well, that's not it. That's not all of it, because there's a first-person perspective on man, too. A naive perspective on man, a traditional historical perspective on man, that's important as well. And I think that people like Heidegger want to preserve that. Also, I think Heidegger was really worried that implicit within the scientistic and the racialist project in particular was the idea that you could basically answer metaphysical questions with scientific means. And I don't think that's the case. That can't happen. But I think that if you simply get rid of the scientistic ambition, right, the idea that, well, science is enough on its own, it's got pragmatic groundwork, it doesn't need philosophy, it can be a whole worldview. If you get rid of that, I think you can integrate a scientific approach to things within a general hermeneutical existential philosophy like you have with Heidegger, within a humanistic, a basic humanistic orientation. I don't think science and humanism necessarily conflict.
I agree, but you see where scientism happens with our people is that they see all these abuses of the Frankfurt School and all these language games that they're playing with our race and our history, and they hang white knuckle to the most, what they perceive as the most ironclad warrant that they possibly can through science, and they become more rigid about it than ever, and they become imperviously welded to these ideas.
Sure, well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the humanities today, the temptation is to say, just burn it all down, you know, salt the ground and start anew. You know, I totally understand that. I understand that instinct. Sometimes I even entertain such notions when I get, when I read something like Gawker or something, I just think, these people have shit for brains. You know, everybody who comes out of humanities departments today should be forced to, we should have our cultural revolution and send these people out to dig ditches or something. We need a complete purge of the chattering classes, a complete purge of the universities, etc.
What's that one great quote? When I hear someone use the word culture, I reach for my revolver.
Yeah, that's been...
That was Adolf. Mussolini.
No, it's been attributed to Goering, okay. And also to, a fellow named Hans Jost, who was like the Reich's Chamber Theater Commissioner or something like that. I'm sure he had a special uniform and dagger for that office. I mean, one of the things that cracked me up is I discovered that that postal inspectors in this Third Reich had a special uniform, a dress uniform, and a special dagger issued to them. So... I find that really charming.
They weren't hung up on authenticity, you see, Greg.
Well, I think they felt that was really authentic. That chimed in well with their sense that, well, you know, it chimed in with the kind of Prussian socialism, right? That every office, every duty in society should be invested with utmost seriousness.
Yeah.
And that meant even in external accoutrements like uniforms and daggers for postal inspectors and things like that. So I think that there is something authentic and charming and very German and Ernst about things like that. It doesn't sit well with us Anglo-Saxon types, I know, but
Okay, just to move the thing along a little bit, we've talked a lot about Germany and National Socialism, and it's obviously a continuing theme in American WN in particular, not least because of the number of German Americans involved in it. And a lot of the intellectuals who are on the continent certainly are closer to the fascists than I would be or would want to be. We have a large number of political parties, particularly in Europe today, who describe themselves as ethno or ethnic nationalist. The difference between ethno and ethnic appears to be basically the one that's been prescribed by people like Smith, who's a Jew, who came up with, I think, the idea that ethnic nationalism is sort of archaic tribes and what have you, and these third world peoples, all of whom have their sacred rights to the soil, which we must certainly avow and support and all the rest of it, terribly. But in Europe, it becomes ethno-nationalism, which has nothing whatsoever to do with peoples, because, of course, they're just mixtures. They don't have any identity. There isn't an identitarianism at work there. And frankly, you know, it's just about geography. It's not how I think any ethnic nationalists would actually view it. We would obviously see ourselves as being identitarians. But do we have a philosophy of identity? And if we did, would it look remotely like National Socialism? Or do we need to be thinking hard about a really live alternative, a new basis that might have, I think, something to do with Heidegger? This is, after all, an existential problem that we face. What's your thinking about that, Greg?
Well, I think that Heidegger was a part of the old right. He was a National Socialist, and so looking at Heidegger as an alternative to National Socialism, well, that's an interesting question. Heidegger became a National Socialist. He was disappointed with National Socialism. He became increasingly critical of it. After the war, he became rather silent, and then he started speaking again. And it was clear that there was a continuity between his thinking before and after the war. Politically, his focus had changed. He started talking about technology, the uprooting of man from the world by a kind of global technological civilization. But that's all totally consistent, in my view, with the underlying concerns of the right. And the way I look at Heidegger is that Heidegger was a National Socialist who was a dissident National Socialist. He was not a racialist. He didn't take scientific race seriously enough. He was truly an ethno-nationalist rather than a racial nationalist. I think that he really believed that the operative unit for Europeans is going to be the ethnic group and the ethno-state. I think that if you sat him down, you could probably argue him into understanding that there is an importance of race, because the reason why we have to bring race in is that it's a boundary, it's a barrier to complete ethno-assimilationism, right? If it's just a matter of culture and ethnicity, then why not talk about the assimilated Jew or the assimilated African or the assimilated Muslim? Is there anything that stands in the way of assimilating radically different peoples into your culture?
Apart from nature.
If race is not, yeah, apart from nature, no, exactly. Or sort of deep historical contingencies that they can never get outside of. That would be the other answer. But we do have to address the role of race. We do have to address bring up race when the assimilation question comes into play. And I don't think Heidegger adequately dealt with that. Yeah. Heidegger would be an ethno-nationalist rather than a racial nationalist, but I think that we could probably bring him around if he were still alive and we could actually
get through his thick head.
You know,
politically, ethno-nationalism in Europe, obviously this is not connected to the situation in America, which is a problem of a different nature on a different scale. In Europe, the struggle is for the survival of the group, not the culture, not tradition, you know, not any proxy for the group. The struggle is the survival of the group. It is an existential struggle.
I would agree with that. We have to get clear about what's essential, who we really are. We are not cultural conservatives, because culture can be, our culture, Western culture, will be in some ways conserved by the Japanese and Chinese. They like Western classical music. So it's not cultural conservatism. We could lose all of our culture and we can create another great culture again if we maintain the integrity of our race, because that's the wellspring from which our cultures spring. That is the important thing. We're not defending Christendom. Christendom is a category that only accidentally somewhat overlaps with who we are, the race. We're defending our race. And so we have to get clear about that. If I had to choose between Western civilization and Western man, namely the white race, I would choose the race. That's who we are. Now, the Europeans have a slightly different situation because you still have more specific groupings within the race. You've still got very robust national identities. And I think those are wonderful things to hold on to. In the colonial realm, like the United States and Canada and Australia and South America, where they're, you know, wherever there are whites, these whites are profoundly mixed with one another now. You really have a more generic white European in America. I did I had a meeting once of some Countercurrents writers and readers and supporters. There were 42 people in the room, and I asked the people to raise their hands if they were of mixed European ancestry, and 40 hands went up. The only two people who didn't have mixed European ancestry had not been born in the United States or Canada, right? One was German, the other was Scottish. Everybody else born in North America was of mixed European ancestry. So that does change things a little bit.
A lot.
Racial nationalism makes more sense, just a purely racial nationalism makes more sense in the colonies than it does in the mother continent. I do think, though, that we should have something of a broader racial awareness that supervenes upon our more compact national identities. I think that's very important.
Right. Let me just get back to what I was talking about before, because you've re-raised two issues which are significant in this respect. You mentioned consciousness and you mentioned identity, and these constitute the very core of ethnic nationalism. Without consciousness of self and identity, it's simply, you know, not possible for a people to express itself politically, to have a will. So we come back again to this question of the philosophy which is missing currently, and we have to, it's an absolutely sacred duty, we have to find some system that we can put into place that is going to enable our efforts as identitarians to be rooted intellectually for
well, I think it was
the way we live.
It was set forth by Heidegger in hermeneutics as a response to the teleological and then the Cartesian. The technology of that, this objectivism, which is from Europeans and they're understandably enamored of, but they got carried away with in some senses and has been taken advantage of by Jews who seek to capitalize on our weakness and our susceptibility to this, the power of this search for pure warrant. And Heidegger begun to address this, and I think that Greg was saying quite rightly that he didn't take this far enough.
He didn't take it far enough because
he didn't begin it, and he looked at Aristotle's three-part arrangement of theoria, praxis, and poesis, and he wanted to bring that Cartesian overreach into the realm of praxis, making our people the center of our concern rather than objectivism, which is where we begin to veer into authenticity of concern, or one of the ways we might begin to veer into authenticity of concern. And this was begun even earlier in Aristotle in Nicomachean Ethics, that he wanted to call more attention to praxis, that is the social world. So that's where I see it as Heidegger brought it. If you want to talk about a philosophy, an anti-Cartesian philosophy taken further, it's got to be hermeneutics out of the corrupt hands of Jewish interests, like his students Gadamer and Hannah Arendt, who corrupted these ideas.
I want to give this to Greg to answer, because this has got to be rooted back into how far Heidegger is usable, how much agency is in that. I mean, just to complete the question, I mean, the point is that when you talk to, particularly to American nationalists, you find when you scratch the surface a little bit, you know, that they're still liberals because they're living in a liberal system and they can't put it down, they can't give it up. It's like Hotel California, you know, you can check out any time you like, but you can never leave.
And that's related to Cartesianism.
Well, that's related to the systemic nature of liberal thought and its relationship to the model of life that we're leading, this disastrous model of life that we're leading.
But don't you see that individualism is based on a kind of a technology of individual rights?
Individualism is many aspects of individualism.
There's a key aspect of technology, a technology of individual rights, which is divorced from connection with the social group. And Heidegger was trying to address this divorce of the knower to known and its inauthenticity and bring it back into a non-Cartesian sense, which was Desain their being, and as Michael O'Meara was saying, mit Desain, their being amidst the group of the people.
I don't see there being different kinds of being, and I don't look at being like that. I can't see it like that. All of these different varieties, or four, five, six of them, that Heidegger manufactured. This is all contextual. They weren't individual in themselves.
But it's got to keep turning over and over.
That happens because fundamentally he saw being as ground. He never really got away from this sort of Platonic ground, and to me,
you like of being. I thought that was interesting.
Well, I arrive from a completely different perspective, which is that I put identity in front of being. When identity is gone, then that being is gone. It's dependent.
There's this term in existentialism, this kind of slogan that for the existentialist, existence precedes essence.
Yes.
Whereas with the traditional sort of Platonic Aristotelian philosophy, essence precedes existence.
Yes.
You know, for somebody like Heidegger, he's going to say, look, ultimately what that means is that contingency is prior to necessity in a way. And the way I look at it is this is consistent with actually Darwinism, oddly enough. Yeah. I mean, Darwinists claim that species are not eternal, right? You know, for a species is a paradigmatic notion of what the Platonists and Aristotelians would call being, right? It's a kind, it's a natural kind.
Yes.
Platonists and Aristotelians had this idea that natural kinds are eternal. Darwin says, no, natural kinds are not eternal. Natural kinds emerge in time and they emerge through contingency. Right, they didn't have to happen, but these things happen, and that once these identities emerge, then they become, if you will, the origin of necessity. Why? In what sense? Well, there's certain things they can do and certain things they can't. Right? If you have a certain identity, that means that you have a certain set of possibilities and a certain set of things that simply are not possible to you. And so, I think in a way that what we need to do is, philosophically, we need to get back to ideas that close off this notion of the infinite malleability of man, mm-hmm. because that really is the metaphysical presupposition of liberal utopianism. Liberal utopianism cannot happen unless man is infinitely malleable, and the things that seem to radically differentiate us are merely, quote unquote, social constructs that could be deconstructed.
Greg, I really think these ideas are very related to this infinite malleability thing is very much Jewish. I mean, I don't think that that's something that And it,
well,
and,
I mean, it's and not I, necessarily I, Jewish because, you know, it's been with us for a long time, and I don't think it has anything to do with Judaism. When you go back to Herodotus, the father of history, Herodotus traveled around and he noticed that some things stayed the same no matter where he was, and some things radically differed. Customs, conventions radically differed, and nature stayed the same. Then you had the sophists come along, and the sophists basically preached the notion that convention was more important than nature. I mean, these sorts of notions are very ancient, and they're endemic to
okay, but I
Western
I want,
man.
I want to digress for just a second. Social constructionism, as I understand it, does not think that people are infinitely malleable, and it doesn't say that you can do just anything. You can construct people in a way to a certain extent. At the other extreme, construction is a matter of deciding how facts count, but it doesn't mean that you can do just anything. And what it does allow for is a certain amount of agency, and it goes to that contingency that you're talking about, a certain amount of agency, responsibility, accountability, as they always say, and warrant. And I think that I see it as important to hold on to in its proper form. And I think that it goes back to Vico's anti-Cartesianism, and Heidegger was influenced by that as well, by Vico's term.
Well, for me, the essential problem that we have to face philosophically is a return to limits, right?
We are
political realists in a deep sense, and what that means is that there are limits to what can be done politically.
I agree. I don't disagree with that.
Yeah. There are two sources of these limits that we need to look to in the philosophical tradition. One is the notion of nature, and the other is the notion of what I'm going to call, you know, deep, robust contingency. And ultimately, I think that if Darwin is right, and if evolutionary accounts of cosmology are right, that is what is ultimate. What is ultimate is not eternal form, an eternal order. What's ultimate is contingency, but contingency, once it happens, is no longer contingent. It imposes necessity, right? So, you know, we didn't have to have two sexes or whatever. But once that differentiation came into existence, it was baked into all future evolution, right? And so that is a contingency that cannot be undone, right? We can pretend that we can undo it, but that's only cosmetic, right? It's just utterly absurd. Sexual difference is older than the human race, and yet feminists want to argue that it's a human social construct in some sense that they can change.
Just a human social
construct. Yeah, a mere human construct. I mean, that's the kind of insanity that we are combating. And I look to the philosophical tradition, to the classical ancient philosophers, and to more robust historicist existentialist thinkers like Heidegger as two sources of limits that we can appeal to. And ultimately, I think, metaphysically speaking, it's going to be the kind of robust historicist contingency philosophers who really have the ultimate truth, because I just don't think that eternal forms exist.
Aristotle's good for that as well, because with this talk of definition of the nature of human beings as biological creatures, that they're evolved for optimal levels of need satisfaction, not maximal, or maximal and minimal being toxic. And there's a difference there from popular understanding, and also humans as mammals being concerned for relationships. So that would be a contrast to the liberal philosophy that you can just do anything.
Yeah, I think that in the broadest sense, again, what we need is a philosophy of limits. And because what we're up against is really people who want to discard reality in order to live a moralistic fantasy life.
Mm. Well, not only moralistic, but I mean, the very core of liberalism, the very heart of liberalism, is the unfettered will, the breaking of all boundaries, and the self-authoring of identity. That is the absolute heart of it. And if you were to give it a proper name, I guess you would say it's the replacement of God the Creator with man the Creator. And right. That's perhaps how Christianity moved into liberalism and never really left it. The problem that exists for us exists as we are nationalists, as much as it exists because there are liberals in this world who want these crazy things. Because even as nationalists, we're still liberals. We're still living the liberal life. This is, of course, something that is constructed, by the way.
Can I tell you where my talks broke down with Kevin MacDonald? And I think that it comes to bear on where the right, and what's being called the right, has contributed to liberalism. And in one sense, it's through radical skepticism, which is concomitant with scientific quests and its improper implementation in scientism. And these are not only Jewish, they stem from us to a large extent. When I tried to suggest that to Dr. MacDonald, he said that no, radical skepticism was only from the Frankfurt School, and hermeneutics is only anti-science. And I'm sure that that's not the case. I'm sure that hermeneutics is European, and it can be applied properly in our interest. And I also think that radical skepticism is something that science is susceptible to, and it leads to scientism, which I think has something to do with misapplied liberalism. Anyway, thoughts on that from either of you?
Well, Greg, you've been quiet for a while. I think it's your turn.
Well, first of all, just a little side point. Gadamer, Hans-Georg Gadamer, who I think is Heidegger's most illustrious student, wasn't Jewish. He was a good German.
He wasn't Jewish? I always thought that he was.
No, he was a German and one of Heidegger's, I think he was certainly Heidegger's greatest student. He was practically his only really great student who wasn't Jewish when you get right down to it. There are a lot of famous people who were more or less Heidegger students.
I'll take your word for it. I have to.
Yeah. There was, Hannah Arendt and Leo Strauss, Hans Jonas, Herbert Marcuse, all of them were to one extent or another students of Heidegger. Karl Löwit, all of them were Jewish. Heidegger had a large number of Jewish students. There's no question about it. But again, you can't swing a dead cat in academia without hitting Jews. So yeah. Exactly. So
that's why I couldn't stand it there.
Yeah. Well, it's even worse in America than it was in Germany in the 1920s, let's face it. But anyway, look, there's no question that science works, that science gives us knowledge. In my mind, that's simply unquestionable. Mm-hmm. Science gives us knowledge. The only question is does science have priority over the first person, naive, commonsensical human perspective? And I would say no, but I don't necessarily think it claims that priority.
It operates as a kind of wall against which the fruit of philosophical thought must grow. They deal in different domains. One has life in it, as it were, and one is reductive, and it tends towards a fractured way of seeing the world. But the wall is solid, and whatever grows against it has to be cognizant of its truths. That's my own view, that if something is not true in science, then it cannot be argued for in philosophy.
But you might not be able to see the truth, its truth in the whole pattern.
Well, for example,
that's the problem with science. It doesn't have sufficient historical perspective.
If we had a proper understanding,
and that's where hermeneutics is a corrective to the limited purviews of science.
Hang on a minute. Let's go straight into the most difficult area for science, which is consciousness. Okay, it is very, very difficult to see and to actually draw any conclusions about it from a scientific basis. You can see when somebody's asleep, you can see the brain waves, you can see very broad terms, but you can't see anything specific. You can't see
again, why is consciousness so important?
Consciousness is important because without consciousness, there is no sense of identity. And without sense of identity, there are no limits. It's linking to what Greg is saying, that the sense of identity is the first limit, is the first unit that says, I am. And, you know, not I am also.
I'll buy that. I would put it in slightly different terms, but
I'm not a philosopher. I'm a very crude thinker.
I would put it in terms of accountability.
Okay, right. Let's suppose, just for a moment, that science was able, through some magnificent new theory that opened up the capacity to comprehend the way that consciousness functions. Okay, so we're talking about this great dynamic which goes from, you know, absence and mechanicity and darkness, exile at one end, to luminosity, self-annihilation, and pure being at the other. And this is the great traditional dynamic that human consciousness is reckoned to. Let's suppose that science was able to absolutely clarify each of the stages, each of the little connected movements and where the breaks are, like the keyboard of the piano. Let's say that science could explain it in a definitive way. What would existentialism make of this knowledge? Would it go on theorizing in complete denial of the existence of this knowledge? Or would it have to say, okay, there is this knowledge. We can't use it because it is the product of a kind of thinking that divides everything up and leaves it lifeless on the floor. And we're seeking to connect and to create a vivifying flow. So how would it do it? It would have to say to itself at every stage of its work, am I still respecting the truth as it has been revealed in science? And that's the connection. If it's not true, you end up with false models. Liberalism is a false model. There is no such thing as the unfettered will. You can't break nature. You can reform personality.
I need to make one quick comment on what you say, Gidoli, yeah. Is that the scientific perspective, in as much as it's not corrected for its Cartesian trajectory, is going to be ultimately blind to its own person position, because it's trying for pure objectivity to where the subject is no longer existence. It's pure objectivity, and I just wanted to interject.
No, you're quite right about that. That is the limit of scientific investigation, but its truths still hold. And you can't just say, well, we're philosophers, we have a superior way of addressing these things.
But the thing is, but hermeneutics is offered as a corrective to scientism. It does offer a perspective on not only in history, but on the potential to conceptualize the full social system of the human ecology of the race, and accountability to it.
Well, that all good things, all good things will vivify, all can contribute. But ultimately, in our work, I say our, and I don't particularly include myself.
Yeah, it's ours. But
ultimately, you know, we have to find a way to raise the consciousness of our people so that they can discover and experience and know their own identities and live their own free lives. Freedom is an important part of this. We haven't talked about freedom. But the Heideggerian conception of freedom is very slight, but very beautiful. And, you know, I think he was damn right on that. I think that freedom is this sort of prior thing that you don't achieve it and possess it. It doesn't belong to you in that way. It's more subtle and operates beneath us and is a kind of prior ground on which we can rest in a certain state of consciousness. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that we have to find ways and means of bringing into the general intellectual field.
My experience of academia was that Jews were screwing with these ideas heavily. But they're turning people off to some really good ideas.
Mm.
And they're corrupting our ideas.
Yeah, but, I mean, they will do what they do. It's a bit like, you know, we're standing in a gale.
Well, they have Kevin McDonald thinking that hermeneutics is Jewish and anti-science. Mm. It's not. That's how powerful and how bad their influence is, and how bizarre an interpretation on of Western philosophy that they're, that they're wielding.
Greg, when I mailed you, I made one last point, which reads as follows. When all technical problems are resolved and an alternative philosophical structure exists, how do we address the problem of winning support, first among nationalists who are foundationally national socialists or fascists, but beyond our own people who aren't interested in an identitarian approach? How do we drive our own thinking into the mainstream academic world? Do you have any ideas about how these things can be achieved? Because if they can't be achieved, then we don't have a hope of success.
Well, in terms of convincing our own people, success, I think, will bring people along. I have a lot of supporters and friends who are deeply immersed in the National Socialist worldview and classical fascism. I mean, that's where I come from too. That was a really strong influence on me. And yet at the same time, when something doesn't work, or when times have changed and we're not living in a context in which those things will work, you have to start looking around for new approaches. And I think that really what the new right is, it consists of people who share the same basic worldview and value structure and the same basic goals as the old right. And by old right, I mean classical National Socialism and fascism, the far right between the two world wars, up to the end of the Second World War. They share that, a lot of the new right goals, outlook and so forth, but they realize that times have changed and that there have to be new ways of putting these ideas into circulation and into practice. And therefore, they're going back. They're going back before to the conservative revolution, but they're also looking at present day situations. They're looking at what the new left did. I think what the new left did is in some ways a parallel to what the new right is doing. The new left achieved power in the West, basically, through cultural subversion and achieving cultural hegemony, not through revolution and bloodshed and concentration camps. And what the new right is basically doing is following the same pattern. It's a Gramscian march through the institutions and attempt to change people's consciousness on a fundamental level and create a new pro-white European intellectual hegemony. Now, that brings us to the question, marching through the institutions, how are we going to do that? Well, fortunately, we don't have to at this point. I think eventually our ideas will become more current within academia and so forth. It might take a new political regime. I honestly think that we are going to have a kind of cultural revolution. We are going to have to basically fire every person in the chattering classes who's a leftist and send them out to work in the fields, and just replace all of that from the ground up. In the meantime, what do? In the meantime, fortunately, we have our own media now. And we have, in a way, our own academy now. As college education becomes enormously expensive, and as it becomes, certainly in the United States, to the point where it's no longer an advantage to people in terms of their life prospects, but it's actually a huge ball and chain of debt that they're shackling themselves to. And when education doesn't really educate anyway within the liberal arts field, it's just a lot of politically correct swill, let's face it. People who have genuine interests in liberal education and in the Western tradition and so forth have an alternative. They can go outside academia. They can come to people like us. That's really the ambition of Countercurrents, is to create a kind of think tank, publisher, online encyclopedia, an alternative academy.
It's a noble goal.
Yeah, that's what I want to do. And believe me, there are more and more people like me who are attracted to this. And I got a PhD in philosophy. I would never recommend to people to get PhDs today unless they're independently wealthy, right? And they can do it because it's really interesting, but they don't really hold out any hope of making a career out of it. Those are the only people I recommend that to. at this point, I recommend to people that they become as independent as possible by becoming small business people or large business people, why not? Mm-hmm. And that they educate themselves by unplugging from mainstream academia, unplugging from the mainstream media, and coming to our alternative media, our alternative academia. And that's what's forming. And I think that we will eventually change enough minds, and that the existing system will impeach itself sufficiently, discredit itself sufficiently, that that there will be a change. That's what I'm banking on. That's what I'm hoping for. Again, I ultimately believe that there are limits, and nature is on our side.
Yes.
And I think that authenticity is on our side, too. And I think that when the reigning illusions crash, when the reigning illusions liquidate themselves, there will still be people in need of a worldview. There will still be people in need of a political outlook, of a political program. And it's really our duty to create a robust counterculture to sustain these ideas until such time as there's actually an opportunity for them to become the reigning ideas of a new society.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful statement. And, you know, I'd very much like in the future to talk with you again at a deeper level, perhaps on Heidegger, or at a more critical level on Heidegger, building on what we've discussed today. And if you think it's worth doing, but I mean, with your permission, we'll be back in touch again sometime, I would say, in May.
That's great. I really appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for having me on.
All right, great. Thanks very much indeed.
Thanks Greg.